Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241, and it's November 20th, and we're going to be in the blood, heart, and circulation chapter today. Maybe finish it up. Hope I can. I could if I talk really, really fast, but I don't know if I want to do that. All right, so let's look at the schedule on the right-hand slide as I try to get my microphone put on my shirt. So November 20th, we should be starting cardiac output, blood flow, and blood pressure today, but we're just a little bit behind. Probably won't start it today, but we'll start it on Thursday, the 22nd. But Thursday the 22nd is Thanksgiving, so we won't be here. So we'll start that a week from today. All right, which is going to be the 27th. So this is looking pretty good, except for chapter 18. This is not looking very good because we're not going to cover that in lecture. And in chapter 20, so chapter 18 won't be on the final exam. Okay, chapter 20, maybe I can make a video, but what I would like for you to do is at least a study guide material, all right, and which is kind of truncated, it's shortened. It doesn't have online questions for you, it just has end of the chapter questions and a couple exam figures, okay, and that's it. So that might be some independent study on your part, but I'll try to cover something there, okay. Bless you. So chapter 18 won't be on the test, will not be on the test. Okay, so you might have some questions about the schedule, but that's all I know at the moment. Okay, I might have some more thoughts on Tuesday, a week from today. All right, does anybody have any questions over the material? Oh, I do have a comment about labs. When you see your lab instructors, go ahead and tell them to forward me the latest and greatest lab grades. As a matter of fact, I do not have lab grades from some instructors. So go ahead and just politely remind them to send them to me frequently. So, because I know you guys have a bunch of tests on that last week as the last day of school on Thursday. You might have a lab practicum, you might have physics finals and biology finals, chemistry finals, math finals. Okay, and that sounds terrible, but just think if you were an instructor like me and you got to grade all those things. That's even a bigger nightmare, okay? So, I mean, the Scantrons aren't a bad deal, but if I have to grade a lot of practicums like I do, that takes a long time. So anyway, when you take the final in here, that will be the end of the class for you, but it's like just the beginning for me. It's kind of funny how it goes. All right, so we were talking about transfusion reactions last time, and maybe I'll go back to a previous slide, start the slideshow, get my cursor working. Okay, we should be ready to go. Get some of these lights turned down. All right, how's that? Wonderful. Okay, I will be writing on the board today too, I believe. Yeah. Then I'll turn those lights back on, and I'll need them really, really fast. All right, so we were talking about a special kind of reaction, and it was a reaction between an antibody and an antigen. All right, so an antibody-antigen reaction is the kind of reaction that produces a transfusion reaction, and it does so by agglutinating blood, which is an antibody-antigen reaction. So that you just kind of have to get ingrained in your mind, because we're going to talk about some other blood reactions that produce almost the same kind of results. Okay, so we got an antigen and an antibody, and what you have to get straight in your mind, where are the antigens located? Where are antigens located? On the surface of the cell. Okay, yeah, on the surface of the cell. And where are antibodies located? They're located in the plasma, okay, which is what, the fluid part of blood. All right, so I'm just going to draw something on the board very abstractly. So here, don't forget I'm colorblind. What does that look like? That looks like a red blood cell, right? Except it's not red, probably, chances are. And over here, we have something that is going to look like an antibody, not drawn to scale, right? Because that's just a molecule. This is trillions of molecules right here. All right, and an antibody kind of looks like a little guy running around in your blood with two hands on him. And these two hands have receptor sites. And what can you tell me about a receptor site and something that's going to bind to that receptor site, which usually we call a ligand? Okay, it's got to match up by shape, right? It's got to match up by shape. So let's draw this antibody so that it has this kind of shape on it. Okay, the two receptor sites like this. And let's draw another antibody next to it. And again, this is floating, antibodies are floating around where? Yeah, in the plasma. Plasma is a good way to think about it. And here is another receptor site, right here. And of course, these things are joined together. That's not so important. Okay, and so that's not on the cell surface, so these are antibodies. And what about this red blood cell right here? Did I draw any antigens on the cell surface? I just drew the cell surface. So maybe let's put some antigens on here. Okay, and let's call this antigen A. Like so. And we're just making up that shape, but it's kind of nice because we're talking about the ABO blood system. All right, so which of these antibodies will be able to bind to this red blood cell? Is it going to be the one on the left or the one on the right? Can you see just by shape that this A will fit really nicely into this receptor site? So we're going to call this anti-A or antibody A. Anti-A because it matches up. What about this one over here? What does that look like? That looks like a B. All right, so let's call this anti-B. And these are found where? Plasma. We want to make sure we say plasma. And so what do we call this A? If those are antibodies, this is the antigen. All right, and then you should be able to tell me what blood type that is, at least in the ABO blood system. Not in other kind of blood groups, but at least for the ABO, and I heard a correct answer over here. And does everybody see that this blood type is type A because it's determined by the antigen that's on the cell surface? Okay, so this is blood type A. Just like so. Okay, so a person with blood type A, can they make anti-A and put it in their plasma? No, because this antigen, okay, the A antigen can bind to the antibody A, and since he has another hand over here, another cell could bind to the antibody, and those two cells will be joined together. And then if another antibody grabs an antigen, okay, then thousands of cells, red blood cells, can get joined together. And when that happens, they all explode, they lyse. And so that's what causes hemolysis or the agglutination reaction. Okay, so blood type A can't make anti-A, but that person does make anti-B to protect themselves from cells that's outside their body. Okay, so let's draw another kind of cell right here and tell me what blood type this person belongs to. What blood type is that? That's AB, because it has both antigens on the cell surface. Okay, and what kind of antibodies are in this person's blood or plasma? Can have none, right, because agglutination will take place. All right, so what you see on the screen is basically what I just drew on the board. They use a little bit different shape, you know, but I just contrived that shape up there to make it match up with A and B blood groups more directly. Okay, and this is what agglutination looks like. And we should understand this slide because of the text that's on it. Okay, if the blood types don't match a recipient's antibodies, agglutinate the donor's red blood cells. Okay, so that's a pretty important statement. It's kind of loaded. All right, so it says what's important here is the recipient's antibodies, not the donor's antibodies, but the recipient's antibodies. So who's ever receiving the blood transfusion has billions and billions of antibodies already working in their plasma. Okay? And the other thing we're interested in is the donor's red blood cells. Really not their antibodies so much. Okay. So blood type O is a universal donor. Why is that? Because it lacks A and B antigens. Right? And because it lacks A and B antigens, the recipient's antibodies won't agglutinate the donor's blood cells. So if I draw another red blood cell right here, what's the blood type of that person? Yeah, blood type O. Neither A nor B antigens on the cell surface. So this is a universal donor, because if we put this red blood cell into somebody's blood that is either B blood or A blood, okay, it won't cause agglutination because there are no antigens on the cell surface. Okay. The opposite kind of reasoning goes for the AB is a universal recipient, because they don't make an anti-A or anti-B. Right? So that won't agglutinate the donor's red blood cells. Right? Now, the donor's red blood cells might have a little bit of anti-A if they're a B type, or might have a little bit of anti-B if they're an A blood type. But when those antibodies are transfused, they really don't cause an agglutination reaction, because there are so few of them compared to the whole blood volume that a person has before they get a transfusion. Okay, so this works pretty well. But of course, if you really go to a hospital, they, number one, if you walk in and say, hey, I need some blood really bad because I've been hemorrhaging, right, they'll never believe you if you tell them what your blood type is. And they always have to check, because there's more than one blood group system, right? And they want to match it up perfectly. So they probably would never mix these blood groups anyway. But under certain circumstances, maybe you would have to do that. Okay, another kind of blood group system is what we call the Rh factor. Okay, and so the Rh factor is, again, an antigen on the cell surface. So if we have a red blood cell right here, we might have an Rh type antigen. And the shape, of course, is different than A and B. Okay? And this person right here would be, what would be the blood type of this person right here? Maybe I haven't described it completely, but in terms of ABO, you could tell me what the blood group is here. O, okay? And because it has the Rh antigen on the surface, it is O positive. Because of it. If there's no antigen on the cell surface, it would be O negative. All right, so this is just a little bit different group. And this causes problems sometimes, because when somebody is, I'm going to remove this. All right, so then what blood type is this? O minus, because there's no Rh antigen. What kind of antibody can this person make that won't agglutinate that Rh antigen? Could they make an anti-Rh antibody? You know what? They can, because there's no antigen on the cell surface right here. Okay, so this person could make anti-Rh, which would agglutinate on a cell that has the antigen on it. All right, so this one would agglutinate. Okay, so let's think that maybe we have a mom that is O negative, no antigens on the cell surface. Okay, they could make anti-Rh, and that person had a baby with a father that's O positive. And it's a 50-50 chance their offspring will either be positive or negative. It's just a kind of a flip of the coin. And what just so happens, if the baby is Rh, what? So here's a baby, here's a mom, I'll get rid of this. So here's mom, here's baby, okay? And what is the mom producing? Anti-Rh, and what does the baby have? The Rh antigen. And what kind of reaction could take place? Agglutination, or an antibody antigen reaction. Okay, and so that condition does open up a couple times. Not so common anymore, because it can be prevented as long as we know the blood types of people before they have children. So what happens is that this antibody from the mom goes across the placenta and starts to agglutinate the fetus's red blood cells. and breaks down their red blood cells before they're born. And we call that erythroblastosis fetalis, or hemolytic disease of the newborn. And so that produces a baby that's highly anemic, but also the breakdown products of hemoglobin when this red blood cell gets broken down, the byproduct of hemoglobin, oh, maybe this is a good refresher time. How does hemoglobin get broken down? What does it get broken down to? Hemoglobin gets broken down to heme and globin. Globin is just a protein. That's good. Okay, but you got this heme group, and the heme group has iron, right? So heme breaks down into iron and eventually bilirubin. And bilirubin is toxic to a developing nervous system, like in the fetus. And it's also a pigment. So this baby would be born with very bright yellow, jaundiced, right colors, yellow eyes, fingernails, things like that, highly anemic and toxic because of that bilirubin in their blood. Okay, so that's why we would always want to know circumstance where the mom is negative and the father is positive. Right, because there could be a 50-50 chance. And there's a way to trick the immune system with a shot called Rogam, and it's really easy to treat. And in the United States, there probably aren't any cases of this particular disease, okay, process. Who's got a question on that? I kind of rushed through it. Somebody has a question. I know somebody has a question. You might be questioning, well, how come if there is a mom with this blood type and a dad with this blood type, okay, how come this doesn't produce a transfusion reaction? Because what kind of antibody is mom going to make? Yeah? Anti-A, and dad makes anti-B. Okay, so there could be a problem of anti-A going across the placenta and attacking the antigens on the baby, if the baby inherits that the gene for blood type A. Okay, but that never happens. And the reason why is because this antibody can't get across the placenta. It's too big and complicated. But the anti-Rh antibody is small enough to where it can cross the placenta. All right, so that's why you never hear of erythroblastosis fetalis caused by an ABO mismatch, only the Rh factor. All right, so just remember that it's all, it works by the shape of the antigen and the antibodies. And what is that process called? Agglutination, okay? And what kind of reaction is agglutination? It's an antigen-antibody reaction, right? And you just got to know that the antigen is on the cell surface, and that determines what your blood type is. So that's not too difficult to appreciate that. Okay, seems complicated, but it's not too bad. Okay, hemostasis is a process of maintaining blood, okay, where you're not bleeding. And we have a couple mechanisms in our body to prevent bleeding or to maintain hemostasis. Because, of course, blood is a connective tissue, kind of a funny one. It's a fluid connective tissue, so if there's damage to a blood vessel, it will just run right out of your body. Okay, here are the two forms of hemostasis that take place in our body. Platelet plug formation is number one for microscopic tears in blood vessels. Right, so tears that you really can't see with your naked eye, and they happen all the time. Okay, and if you have normal blood clotting function, you just don't ever know that they're occurring because you don't have significant blood loss from them. But maybe if somebody's on an aspirin regimen and to maintain cardiovascular health, maybe if they bruise themselves, the bruise will be really prolonged and it will be a very big bruise because that aspirin prevents platelet plug formation. Okay, so that could happen. The second kind is what we call fibrin formation. And fibrin formation is the same thing as coagulation. Now, don't get coagulation and agglutination mixed up, because we just got done talking about agglutination, and now we're going to talk about coagulation in just a little bit. Coagulation is for macroscopic tears in blood vessels. All right, so this is important. So a plug and surroundings are infiltrated by a web of fibrin. So that's what we call that fibrin formation, forming a blood clot. So a platelet plug is not a blood clot, right? A blood clot is an accumulation of fibrin near the damage to that blood vessel. So let's take a look at a blood vessel. Here we got an undamaged blood vessel. Here's a nice healthy blood vessel. Here's the lumen of the blood vessel containing what? What do we see right here? Yeah, we got some red blood cells floating around in there. Okay, and then here is the part of the tunica intima, right? The deepest layer in any kind of blood vessel. And this is just a simple squamous epithelium. But since it's lining the tube, what do we call this epithelium right here? This is really an endothelium because it's lining the tube and it's just a simple squamous epithelium. These are special cells that maintain the health of this blood vessel. And then right underneath is a basement membrane, and I can see some collagen fibers and other kinds of connective tissues, right, holding this squamous epithelium in place. So we have collagen fibers, and then we have these little dots right here. Oh, what are these? What are these colors?
Blue.
The blue dots. That's a special little chemical that we call von Willebrand factor. Okay, and is the von Willebrand factor in contact with the blood in a healthy blood vessel? It is not. It's hidden. It's underneath the endothelium. It's not in contact with the blood. And then there's also an enzyme right here that is on these normal healthy cells that will break down ADP into AMP. All right, because ADP is a chemical that can activate platelets. But if we have a normal healthy cell right here with this CD39 protein, then ADP inside the blood is going to be at a very low concentration, and platelets... I just looked at this slide maybe like for the first time, okay, but I haven't. I've looked at it 100 times and I just saw something that looks a little strange, okay, and I'll show you what that is in just a second. So if their ADP is at a low concentration, platelets in the blood, okay, won't start sticking together. All right, and what I just saw for the first time, I said these things right here look like red blood cells, but guess what I think the illustrator wanted these to look like? Yeah, inactive platelets. And even though they kind of look like a biconcave cell, really think of these as platelets and not red blood cells. Okay, so think of these as platelets. And platelets are just cell fragments. Okay. And the endothelial cells, when they're healthy, secrete nitric oxide and also a prostaglandin that we call prostacyclin, PGI2, and nitric oxide prevents sticking of these platelets and prevent sticking of these platelets to the wall of a blood vessel. And these things also act as vasodilators, which means they keep the blood vessels open. And when a blood vessel dilates, then a lot of blood can enter that particular vessel. All right? So that promotes perfusion or maintains perfusion of tissues, which is good because these red blood cells are going to be carrying oxygen. All right, so let's damage this blood vessel. Let's rip away this endothelial cell. So if we damage this endothelial cell, can it produce nitric oxide and PGI2? It cannot. All right, and then we get rid of this enzyme, the CD39 enzyme. What about ADP in this region of this blood vessel? It's going to start to increase because it's not being degraded. Okay, and if we take away this endothelial cell, now what's in contact with the blood or plasma? You have... it's in contact with the von Willebrand factor as well as collagen. And you probably have some other things, maybe remnants of the cell membrane, phospholipids floating around in the plasma in this location as well. So let's go and look and see what we have. All right, so here's a damaged blood vessel. These cells, okay, so now the von Willebrand factor helps attach platelets to the collagen fibers, okay, and... when they start to attach to these von Willebrand factors, they start to secrete ADP. And since that protein is not available, there's a big increased concentration of ADP, which causes or activates more platelets to stick to this area. Okay? And also platelets, when they start sticking together, release another compound called thromboxane A2 or taxa A2. And that also increases platelet sticking together within the site of that injury. And serotonin is released. Serotonin sometimes is used as a neurotransmitter in the body, but it's also important because it works with taxa 2 to cause vasoconstriction. So what happens to this blood vessel when it starts to vasoconstrict? That reduces blood flow in that vessel, and that prevents or retards hemorrhage as a result. Okay, so when platelets stick together, when they stick to the von Willebrand factor and to collagen, which is normally hidden, of course, then that's what we call a platelet release reaction or platelet plug formation. And this is good at the cellular level, like this would be at the microscopic level to plug this little tear in a blood vessel. Right? And aspirin blocks the synthesis of prostaglandins, okay, like PACTA A2, and thus blocks the platelet release reaction. So that's why sometimes aspirin is used in a little anticoagulation therapy, because it blocks the synthesis of prostaglandins, and that's why people take it for other reasons as well, like for controlling temperature, because it interferes with prostaglandin, and a prostaglandin is just a hormone in the blood signaling different parts of your body to do different things. All right, so serotonin and TACTA2 cause vasoconstriction, reducing blood flow to the wound, and then that stops that hemorrhage from that location. Okay, so this is almost like a positive feedback mechanism, but not quite. All right, we just call that platelet plug formation. Okay, let's go to a little bit larger tear in a blood vessel. And that's when fibrin, which is a protein, precipitates out of plasma. Normally this is a protein that's soluble in plasma. You can't see it. It just becomes part of the solution. All right, and it forms coagulated proteins wherever there is a platelet plug. And that traps more platelets, and it traps red blood cells. And it can then heal over very big tears in blood vessels. All right, so now a blood clot contains platelets, fibrin, that protein, and trapped red blood cells. Okay, and let's take a look at this. Okay, I'm not going to go over this slide right now, except looking at the title. Here we have a compound that we call fibrinogen. Maybe I've talked about this already, but whenever you see a word with a special suffix, which is this last part of the word right here, ogen, on it, that should clue you into something really important. And that is that here is a molecule that can have activity in your body, but if it's in an ogen form, it is inactive. All right, so fibrinogen, just by looking at it, you know, is an inactive compound. But the nice thing is it's at a proper concentration to have a nice physiologic role in your body. If it's converted, if a little piece of this molecule is cleaved away, it can be converted into fibrin very rapidly. Okay, just within half of seconds or seconds, you can have proper concentrations of fibrin in your body. And fibrin is a protein. So if you needed to build a fibrin molecule, you would need protein synthesis. And how many steps are there in protein synthesis? Yeah, there's two. The first step is transcription. The second part is translation, and all that takes time. So it might take a couple of weeks for your body to build up enough fibrin to close off that vascular damage. And during that time, of course, you could bleed to death. But since your body makes a whole bunch of this in an inactive form, fibrinogen, which gets converted into fibrin, then that can stop that hemorrhage. Okay. So let's take a look and see how that happens. Okay, so here is an exam figure. All right, and this is modified a little bit from the one that's in your book. So but this is the one that's on the test. So if you want to know how to answer the one in the study guide, I would refer to this slide that you have in your notes, or you can just look at it online. All right, so this process right here of fibrin formation, okay, is what we call coagulation. All right, this is not agglutination, because what kind of reaction is agglutination? It's an antibody-antigen reaction. This is just a special kind of protein that becomes activated, right, and that special protein is what we call fibrin. Let me see if I can, okay, this is good, what I want to show you. Here I see a bunch of red blood cells, and they're all trapped in this network of proteins. Guess what this protein is? It is fibrin, okay, that's gluing all of these cells together. So this is fibrin. It just forms a nice mesh, and that mesh with trapped platelets and red blood cells forms a blood clot over some wound someplace. All right, so coagulation is formation of what? You see it on this slide right here. Fibrin formation, okay? And where does fibrin come from? It comes from fibrinogen that's in your blood right now, ready to go to work. All right, let's see how this can be activated. Let's see how I can talk about this. All right, we see, it looks complicated, but it's not really too bad. Okay, I see three pathways here. I see an extrinsic, I see an intrinsic, and I see one pathway that's common to both of them, that they both feed certain kinds of metabolites into. Okay, and the extrinsic pathway is how coagulation usually starts in your body, where there's damage to a blood vessel, and there is an enzyme that becomes activated. It's called tissue thromboplastin. And tissue thromboplastin works on another protein that's inside the body that's just called factor 7. Okay? Factor 7 then can activate another inactive compound in your blood that we call prothrombin activator. Here is prothrombin activator, and here it is activated. Prothrombin activator inactive. Here is prothrombin activator in an active form. All right, prothrombin activator can look at this molecule here, can bind to it. This is called prothrombin. Okay, now when you saw a word with an ogen on as a suffix, what does that mean? Inactive but ready to go to work. There's another form of a word that means the same thing, and that is if there's a pro at the beginning. So the activity of prothrombin is it's inactive. But when it's modified a little bit, it can become the active molecule, which is thrombin. All right. So when you need a blood clot, your body doesn't have to build thrombin because you have plenty of prothrombin already in your blood, ready to go to work. All right. So what do we see right here? I see that we have a number of enzymes and then a number of enzymatic steps that are becoming activated to produce the final product that makes that big blood clot that I just showed you. So what do we call this mechanism with a bunch of enzymes? Because remember, when an enzyme converts one substrate to a product, what happens to the activity of that enzyme? It keeps working, right? Enzyme is not destroyed. So what do we have this with many levels of enzymatic reaction? What do we call that? It's some kind of mechanism. It's called a cascade mechanism, and it allows for what? Levels of amplification. So this process can happen very rapidly into a large enough magnitude to maintain hemostasis. So that's why it looks so complicated. All right, but let's look at some of these things over here on the extrinsic pathway. Things that are necessary for coagulation is proper calcium levels in the blood. All right, so that's important. And also phospholipids. And where do you get phospholipids from? Where's a really good reservoir of phospholipids? Plasma membrane, like when a plasma membrane gets ripped open when you damage the endothelium, that releases phospholipids, and that becomes an important activator for coagulation, as well as calcium. All right, so calcium, you should know, is important for a number of things in your body, not just to have strong bones, but for what? Synaptic transmission, muscle contraction, probably some other things I'm forgetting about, and what? Clotting function is very important. All right, so when these things are in the blood, prothrombin activator is formed, okay, and that converts prothrombin to thrombin. So these are the three steps that I think maybe you should have on the tip of your tongue. The first step is prothrombin activator. Prothrombin activator does what? It activates prothrombin, and when you activate prothrombin, what do you get? You get thrombin, because just by nomenclature, you should be able to know that, okay? So, and then prothrombin becomes thrombin, right? So we call that thrombin formation. And thrombin is an enzyme that can take a soluble protein that's in solution, fibrinogen, and cleave it into different pieces that precipitate out of solution to form that network, the fibrin polymer or fibrin network that we were looking at, and we call that fibrin formation. Okay, and look, here's another step. Factor 10 or prothrombin activator also requires what? Calcium and phospholipids. So here's another important step where you need the proper levels of calcium. Okay, here is the intrinsic pathway on the right. And you can see that it contributes to this common pathway. This intrinsic pathway is something that can happen when blood is put in a glass container or when it's another activator for this pathway right here is collagen, for instance, when there is damage to a blood vessel. So when you put blood in a glass container, okay, it's going to cause coagulation, it's going to clot. But there are different ways that you can prevent that from happening. You can prevent that from happening by getting rid of all the calcium that's in the blood. All right, so you can take a blood sample and tie up that calcium with a chelator, EDTA, and that blood will stay a nice fluid if you want to analyze it later on. Okay, so here is a pathway, and again, it's a cascade. So this has all these different levels of amplification, and a number of them need calcium and phosphate, phospholipids. Patients with hemophilia have no factor VIII. Right, so this pathway right here, the intrinsic pathway, is blocked. So hemophilia is a condition where somebody just bleeds. They have very poor blood clotting function. And they could even eventually die of just a paper cut on their finger. They could bleed to death because without intervention, right, because they just can't form enough clotting function to stop even that very small wound. All right, so how does this affect coagulation? Okay, it activates prothrombin activator, right, which then produces fibrin. But this step right here, when thrombin is produced, okay, thrombin goes over to factor 11 and can activate factor 11, all right, which then activates prothrombin activator, which does what? Activates more factor 11, which activates more factor 10, which activates more factor 11, which activates more factor 10. Okay, what does that sound like? That is a nice positive feedback mechanism, again, that speeds up the rate of coagulation, and you should probably just kind of have that in the back of your mind as an example of positive feedback being a normal, natural process in somebody's body, and so coagulation is one of those, okay? And that step is right here. That's not in your book either, but it's kind of novel and interesting. Okay, so that's really all I want you to know about this particular slide. It has a number of different pathways. Don't forget about calcium and phospholipids. And then coagulation is what? Is fibrin formation. And where does fibrin come from? Fibrinogen. Okay, and the compound that can convert fibrinogen into fibrin is thrombin. And thrombin is also contained in your blood in an inactive form called prothrombin. All right, so you can see some vitamin here, vitamin K. The production of prothrombin is dependent on vitamin K, so somebody that doesn't have vitamin K in their diet will have very poor clotting function as a result of that. So you should probably know what a good dietary source of vitamin K is, because vitamins your body can't produce. That's what we call it, a vital amine or a vital compound, essential nutrient. Your body can't make it. That should be in your diet. Does anybody know where you get vitamin K from? Okay, yeah, green leafy vegetables, probably a really good one, is broccoli. All right, and I could tell you a really funny story about that. I had a couple of nephews that were growing up, a bunch of them, like three or four of them, and they hated broccoli. They would never touch broccoli, but they were horsing around all the time. Okay, somebody would end up in a coffee table or the TV set or who knows where, and they would come and see Uncle Joel because they had a nosebleed. Okay, so I would sit them down and I would talk about the extrinsic pathway here and the common pathway. Okay, and how important calcium and the importance of prothrombin and vitamin K, and that vitamin K is contained in broccoli, okay, and that would prevent that blood clot. So I didn't give them a whole lot of sympathy because they would never eat their broccoli. But you know what? My nephews would rather bleed to death at that time than eat broccoli. Can you believe that? I can't believe that, but that's really true. Okay. Okay, so here is just a little synopsis of some of these different clotting factors. You can see some are cofactors, some are actual enzymes, and it's not too important that you memorize all these things, but there are a few key points, like calcium ions are important, right? That's a blood clotting factor. And you have fibrinogen and prothrombin. These are inactive forms. Okay, so there are just some salient features on that slide that you should be aware of. All right, now, why don't you want to call this agglutination? These red blood cells are all stuck together. Kind of looks like agglutination. Why don't you want to call this agglutination? because we're not talking about an antigen-antibody reaction. We're just talking about the precipitation of this fibrin protein, okay, by the action of thrombin, when prothrombin is converted into thrombin. Okay. So, you might say, well, gee whiz, that's really nice that we can form a blood clot to prevent blood loss, but what happens if I cut my finger and then all of a sudden I have a blood clot on my other hand, or in my leg, or in my heart, or my lung, or my brain, and I only want a blood clot there in my little finger, right? So that's really important. So the containment of clots is just as important, and the dissolution of clots is just as important after a tissue heals, is just as important as rushing to that site of injury and producing a clot very rapidly to stop that bleeding. Okay, so when a damage is repaired, there's another factor. Activated factor 12 causes activation of another enzyme that we call kallikrein. And kallikrein causes, acts on plasminogen. And what can you tell me about plasminogen? It's inactive. It's not doing anything in a normal, healthy state. Okay, and it's converted to plasmin. Plasmin has the ability to digest fibrin, break fibrin down, and that dissolves a blood clot. All right, so when you have proper blood clotting function, guess what you have? What do you see happening here? You have plasmin activity, and you have thrombin activity. And what's the relationship between plasmin and thrombin? One makes a clot, the other breaks it down. What do we call that? Antagonism. So you have really nice balanced control over clotting function in your body, right? That's important. It's not just good to have a gas pedal on some important function in your body. So plasmin balances out this work of thrombin. That root gets screwed up in some people, okay, where they're not producing plasmin and they have coagulation taking place all over their body. And they usually don't make it very far, right? Maybe they might make it a half a day, maybe not even, when they have that coagulopathy. All right, so this is a really important concept to understand. Also, I don't think I have any slides on this, but it's interesting because you might be saying, oh, gee whiz, you know, I know some people that had a blood clot in their heart and they had a heart attack. I know some people that had a blood clot in their brain and they had a stroke. Gee whiz, here's a compound that can dissolve that clot away. Maybe that would be good to use on some people that are having these clots in places where they shouldn't have clots, like in their brain or heart. And indeed, that is a therapy in some hospitals where patients are given something that activates plasmin and they can reverse strokes very nicely. It hasn't been really used on heart attacks, but for strokes, it can be really protective. All right, but you can have a stroke for two reasons. Maybe due to a blood clot, or maybe you could have damage to a blood vessel. Maybe you have an aneurysm that breaks open that causes bleeding into the brain. All right, so would you want to give plasmin to somebody that has bleeding in the brain? No, okay, because that will make it worse. So you have to have the proper diagnostic tools to identify what the stroke is the result from before you can institute some kind of therapy like a plasmin, or streptokinase is another chemical that's used to do that. Okay, so you'll have fun with that in the hospital, I'm sure. It's really nice to like erase somebody's stroke before it really happens. That's really amazing. Okay, anticoagulants is a way to reduce coagulation in patients, and also maybe in experimental settings. So calcium chelators like EDTA and sodium citrate can prevent blood from clotting in a test tube. But we don't want to use this in a patient because what happens? What would happen? You would take calcium out of their body. And what would happen then? Well, they would lose clotting function in other parts of their body, but then they wouldn't have muscle contraction, they wouldn't have synaptic transmission and all that kind of stuff. So that can't be used clinically, okay, but it can be used in a lab. All right, two compounds that are used clinically are heparin and coumarin, or sometimes it's called Coumadin. All right, so heparin activates antithrombin 3, which blocks antithrombin. I guess that's pretty clear, right? That just blocks the formation of thrombin, and when you block the formation of thrombin, what are you really blocking? The formation of fibrin formation. So blood clot clotting function is reduced. Of course, you don't want to overdo it because then you'll have bleeding, right? Same thing for coumarin. But coumarin works by a little bit different mechanism. It inhibits activation of vitamin K. And vitamin K works indirectly by reducing calcium availability. Okay, so vitamin K is an important metabolite in your body, and when patients are on Coumarin therapy, okay, then they measure blood levels of Coumarin until they get it up to a therapeutic level. But if somebody changes their diet, all of a sudden starts eating a lot of broccoli, they go nuts on broccoli, guess what happens? Then they no longer have the proper levels of Coumarin in their blood. So somebody that's in Coumarin therapy has to have a constant diet so that it knows, so that a physician would know how to titrate the proper dose. Okay, so that is coagulation and agglutination, and you should kind of know the big difference. So bottom line is, what, coagulation is what kind of reaction? Fibrin formation. And agglutination is what kind of reaction? Antigen-antibody reaction, and then kind of piece it together from there. Okay, so how many sides does a heart have? Okay, it has two. Okay, what are their names? Yeah, right and left. Okay, I know it seems really complicated, but it's not too bad after anatomy. So the heart has two sides. It's got a right side and a left side. And that's because the heart, you know, it's a pump. It's pumping blood, but it's not just one pump. It's really two pumps, right? There's a pump on the right and there's a pump on the left. And the pump on the right pumps blood through your lungs, and we call that the pulmonary circulation. The pump on the left sends it through the systemic circulation, blood through the systemic circulation, which is everywhere else in your body, right? So make sure you know these two different circulations and your heart anatomy. And here's a really good slide. This is good enough even to go in an anatomy book. Okay. Because when you look at this slide, you also see the apex of the heart and the base of the heart. Okay, and then chambers. How many chambers does a heart have? Four. How many valves does a heart have? Okay, pretty good, but, okay, it's the exact number as chambers. Okay, so if I could ask you how many chambers a heart has, you're going to say four. How many valves does the heart have? You're just going to say four, and then you got to figure out where those valves are, right, and remember their names. Okay, and I see a nice systemic circulation here and here, and exchange takes place in capillaries. Here's the pulmonary circulation. So you can see the right ventricle pumping blood to the lungs. That's the pulmonary circulation. Some special things are happening here, like oxygen goes into the blood, CO2 leaves. That's why these pulmonary veins, even though they're bringing blood back to the heart, they're oxygenated because they're coming back from the lungs. Okay, that's the reverse compared to the systemic circulation. In the systemic circulation, arteries are red because they're high in oxygen, bringing blood to tissues. Oxygen is released from the blood, and then it absorbs CO2. So a vein, like the inferior vena cava right here, or superior vena cava, are blue because they're relatively low in oxygen. So these are veins, right? Vena cava is a vein. Systemic vein, it's blue. This one here, pulmonary vein, it's red. So the function of those two circulatory systems are sort of the same. Okay. Structure of the heart. I don't think I can go through any of this stuff because we talk about that in anatomy. And heart valves, maybe I'll go over some heart valves really quickly. Okay, but certainly be familiar with those slides, especially if there are questions at the end of the chapter or online questions regarding heart anatomy. You should know everything because that's where I get questions from the test from. Okay. All right, so I see how many valves on this slide right here? One, two, three, four. Okay, and two of them kind of look similar, and these two up here kind of look similar. And indeed, you could break these valves down into two groups. The ones over here that are very large, these are atrioventricular valves, which means that they're a valve between an atrium and a ventricle, and these are semilunar valves. And these semilunar valves are located right at the root or base of the great arteries, like the aorta and pulmonary artery. Oh, here's anterior, so pulmonary artery and the aorta. All right, so where are these located? Here is a nice coronal section of the heart. I can see some of these valves. Here is the right atrium. Here's the right ventricle. And then the valve right here preventing retrograde flow from a ventricle into an atrium. So this is the tricuspid valve. On the left side of the heart, we have the bicuspid valve because the tricuspid valve has three leaflets or flats and the bicuspid just has these two. Another name for the bicuspid valve, and people use these interchangeably even in one sentence, and so you should know, bicuspid valve is exactly the same thing as mitral valve because it's resembled a hat that certain people wear at certain celebrations. It's called a mitre. Okay, so the Pope will wear a mitre, which is a hat, right, that folds flat, but if you open it up, you can stick it right on your head like that. And cardinals and bishops in the Holy Roman Catholic Church wear these things in very kind of ceremonies. Okay, so that's why we call this the mitral valve, and I see it over here. Here is the pulmonary semilunar valve, and then the aortic semilunar valve is hidden. Can't quite see it. All right, so those are the valves. And what's the function of these valves? Prevent retrograde flow of blood. Blood should flow through the heart in one particular direction, okay? It shouldn't go backwards. And if it starts to go backwards because these valves aren't working properly, then it will eventually kill the heart, all right? And then what happens to the person? Well, it kills the person as well, right? So we have to maintain good heart valve function, and that's done with ultrasound and MRI imaging and all kinds of other interesting techniques. What else did I want to say about these valves? Oh, yeah, they're passive, right? They don't have muscles in them. They just work on a pressure difference. So when the pressure in the ventricle is high, the blood starts to go back up into an atrium, and when it does, it fills up this space underneath a valve leaflet and then pushes it back toward the atrium, and this one over here gets pushed back toward the atrium. So they touch each other, and then that closes the orifice, the atrioventricular orifice, and blood can't move through. The same thing for these cusps on the semilunar valves. Inflate with blood, and when they're inflated, then the margins of those valves touch each other, they approximate each other, and that closes the valve off. Okay, and so blood is going to flow from one chamber to another based on pressure. So when pressure is low in the ventricle, then this valve is open. When pressure is high in the ventricle, then this valve closes. All four are passive. Yep, they're all just passive. Okay, don't require any muscles. That might be, I mentioned that because it might be important later on in the class, but I can't remember where. Okay, remember the chordate tendine and papillary muscles that we have for the atrioventricular valves? These are very big valves, and they would completely invert or poke up into the atria if it were not for these chordate tendine and papillary muscles, and if they were to invert, then they would be completely leaky, right? And then the heart wouldn't be able to pump blood. All right, so that takes us kind of back to physiology, the cardiac cycle, but you got to know your heart anatomy for sure. All right, the cardiac cycle is just a repeating pattern that goes over and over and over again. It's a pattern of contraction and then relaxation of the heart. So there's two main phases. Contraction part and relaxation. We define contraction as systole, and we define relaxation as diastole. That's the relaxation phase. All right, and so everybody's really interested in how the heart pumps blood. All right, so when the heart contracts, what phase is that when the heart contracts? Systole. We call that systolic function. So when the heart is nice and strong, it can pump a lot of blood. All right, so that's a very important phase of the heart cycle. When the heart gets weaker, it can't pump blood. And your blood pressure is going to drop, right? Which is not good. That might produce shock. All right, so everybody's interested in systolic function. And for a long time, people weren't so interested in diastolic function. But I want to point out to you that it's just as important as systolic function. Okay, because in order for the heart to pump blood, what has to happen? It has to relax, and blood has to get into the heart, right? So if the heart goes into systole, okay, and it doesn't fill with blood, even if it's strong, right, and goes into another contraction, if there's no blood in the heart, then it won't pump any blood anyway. So diastolic function is just as important. All right, so systole happens, all right, first the atria contract together, which are the two chambers, the two superior chambers, then that helps fill up the ventricles with blood, okay, so that when the ventricles contract, then there's plenty of blood in there. All right, so atria contract both together, followed by both ventricles. And remember, we have two circulations in the body. We have systemic and pulmonary. The normal blood pressure is 120 over 80. That's a good normal blood pressure for a young person. Okay, and why the heck are there two numbers right here? Okay, because one is the systolic pressure. This is the high pressure, which is produced when the heart is undergoing contraction. And then the other is the lowest pressure, which occurs during relaxation phase of the heart or diastole. That's why two numbers are given. Okay, and these numbers are pretty helpful. There are other ways of looking at blood pressure by looking at the actual curve of what the blood pressure curve looks like. Okay, and there are other physicians in traditional Chinese medicine that actually can palpate somebody and figure out what their blood pressure is. They probably can't give you a number, but they can tell you what the pressure pulse feels like to them. Okay, so that's really interesting. In the pulmonary system, all right, so this is blood pressure in your lungs, it's a lot less. It's only 25 over 10. And that's because the pulmonary circulation is a lot shorter. And that decreases the resistance. So we're going to work with some equations. And so if the resistance decreases to get the same amount of blood flow through a blood vessel, it requires less pressure. So that's why the right ventricle, if you remember back from anatomy, is a lot thinner. It's not as strong a muscle as the left ventricle, because the left ventricle has to pump blood through the whole systemic circulation, which is a lot longer circuit. It has more resistance. It requires more pressure. Okay, I want to go over just a bunch of definitions, and we're going to start working with some of these definitions next time. The end-diastolic volume of the heart refers to the volume of a chamber. Most usually it's the left ventricle, but it could be the right ventricle as well. And we don't usually look at the volumes of the atria, but we could, right? And the end-diastolic volume is the volume of a ventricle when? At the end of diastole, end of relaxation. So is that going to be a big volume or a little volume? Okay, and you know what? During diastole, the heart is relaxed, and when it's relaxed, it fills with blood. And if it's relaxed, it fills with more blood. And if it's still relaxed, it fills with more blood. So the end diastolic volume is what? The big volume, okay? Sort of a little trick. All right, and then the heart contracts, and when it contracts, it's going to pump out a certain aliquot of blood, a certain volume of blood, and we call that the stroke volume. We measure that in milliliters, and then this end-diastolic volume we can measure in milliliters as well. That's just the volume. So stroke volume is the amount of blood that's ejected from the ventricles during systole, because systole is contraction. Okay, so every time the heart, you can think of like an engine, every time the piston goes up, that's, we call that the stroke on that piston, and the volume is the displacement in that motor. Okay, another important volume is the end systolic volume. And what can you tell me about systole? Systole is what? Relaxation or contraction? Contraction. All right, so at the end of systole, when everything's contracted, is that a big volume or a small volume? That's a small volume. Okay, but there's going to be some blood left in the ventricle. A ventricle can't contract completely and get 100% of the blood out. It can only get a certain fraction, and we call that the ejection fraction. Maybe I'll mention that officially in this class in a later slide. Okay, but so we call that the end systolic volume, and if we know the end diastolic volume and end systolic volume, we can always calculate the stroke volume, the amount of blood that's ejected from the heart. Okay, so you should know these questions. Which is larger, ESV or EDV, end diastolic volume or end systolic volume? You're going to have to write that down a number of times, work with a couple of equations or something until you get it on the tip of your tongue, but it is what? The end diastolic volume is the larger one. Okay, what is the stroke volume if, and you can do this calculation at home, what's the stroke volume if the end systolic volume is 20 and the end diastolic volume is 80? You don't have to do it at home. Probably don't even need a calculator. It's just what? One minus the other. It's going to be 60 mLs. Okay? That is the stroke volume. Okay. So as the ventricles contract, okay, when it starts to contract, the pressure inside of a ventricle increases. And when the pressure in a ventricle increases, it gets higher than the pressure in the atria, which is the chamber above it. Right, blood starts to flow back from the ventricle into an atria when that happens, but there's something that's going to stop that retrograde flow of blood. And what is that? What do we have between an atrium and a ventricle? We have an atrioventricular valve. You should have two by name. You got the tricuspid on the right side, bicuspid on the left side. Okay. And when the AV valve closes, all the valves to that ventricle are closed, The ventricle is still going to contract, but because all the doorways to that ventricle are closed, no blood can enter or leave. So what's the volume of that blood if it can't enter or leave? You know what? It stays the same. But the heart is contracting, so the pressure increases, the volume stays the same because blood can neither enter or leave the ventricle. We call that isovolumetric contraction because all the valves in the heart are closed. But the pressure can change because the heart is still contracting. All right, when pressure goes above the pressure in the aorta, right, then blood can flow from a ventricle into the aorta, right? And when that happens, the semilunar valves open up and the ejection phase of the heart begins. The blood can start to leave because that door has opened. A semilunar valve is just a doorway. All right, so the heart then is no longer in an isovolumetric contraction. The volume is changing if blood is leaving the ventricle. Okay, and as the pressure in the ventricle falls below that in the aorta, blood starts to flow back from the aorta into the ventricle, but there's something there to prevent that from happening. And that's the aortic semilunar valve. It closes. It slams shut. All right, so then all the valves again are closed on the heart. All right, so blood can either enter or leave, but the heart is still relaxing, and the ventricle size might get a little bit bigger. All right, but not very much because blood can't enter or leave, and so we call that the isovolumetric relaxation phase. So there are two isovolumetric phases, which I'll show you on the next graph. Okay, when pressures in the ventricles fall below the atria, okay, then blood can flow from the atria into a ventricle, so the atrioventricular valves open at that time, and the ventricles start to fill. And, of course, the atria contract a little bit, atrial systole, then sends a little bit of extra blood into the ventricles before the ventricles contract. All right, so here is what we call a Wigger's diagram. It used to be in your textbook, a really nice diagram that I like, the one that's in your study guide, the one that's on the test. Okay, it looks kind of complicated, but I know you're going to have fun with this one. This is a really good one for you to understand the cardiovascular system. Okay, so I'm going to go over it today and maybe even again a little bit next time. But work on the one that's in your study guide, and there's a key in your study guide. And I learned just a couple of weeks ago that that figure is no longer in your lab manual, unfortunately, okay, because it's a really good figure. But let's go over a Wigger's diagram. The x-axis right here is just time. So we're going to plot out a number of physiologic parameters versus time. Okay, contraction of the heart, some electrical activity of the heart versus time. And let's start with this one right down over here. This is the, let's start with this one right here. Oh, too bad I don't know the color. It looks really dark. Is that purple or dark blue or what? Dark blue, purple. Okay, I'm not the only colorblind person in here. That's why I always like to ask. Okay, well, this dark color right here is a measure of voltage on the surface of your body versus time. And that voltage changes depending on activity of the heart, different activities of the heart. And we call that the electrocardiogram. I don't know if you've done this in lab yet or not. Hopefully so you're kind of familiar that we can actually measure heart electrical activity even on the surface of your body. The first wave in the ECG is what we call a P wave. Probably somebody named it the primavera wave, right? Which means what? First wave. They could have named it number one, but they just say P. And then they noticed another wave, wave number two. Well, what comes after P? Yeah, I wouldn't put a 2, I'd say Q, okay? And then here's the third one, here's the fourth one. So they just got all those different letters, probably starting with P right here is how it probably started. All right, so the P wave represents activity in an atria, and the QRS complex represents special activity in the ventricles, all right, followed by this T wave right here. All right, so this is just plotted out versus time. Also, your heart makes a bunch of noise because of the closing of valves, not necessarily because of the opening of valves in a normal heart. So when systole begins, there is a valve that closes. This is the first heart sound. Okay, and then there's a second heart sound. All right, and we're going to take a look at all these things, but I just want you to know this is when the heart is making noise. Here's electrical activity in the heart. We have two other graphs to look at on this figure. One is pressure versus time. And it's pressure in an atrium that I see on this line right here, and pressure in a ventricle, which is this line here, a lighter blue, perhaps? Yeah, lighter blue. And this one, who knows, gray. Down over here. Okay, so we got pressure in an atrium, pressure in a ventricle, and pressure in the aorta. And what can you tell me about pressure in the aorta for a normal person? What should it be? It should be, on a previous slide, should be 120 over 80. And is that what we see on this slide? What's the peak pressure right here in the aorta? It looks like if we go over, really close to 120. All right, and then when the heart goes into diastole, the pressure starts to decrease. All right, so but let's go back over to here. It decreases, and what pressure is that? 80. All right, so that's just a nice normal range of blood pressure in somebody's systemic arteries. Not pulmonary circulation, but at least the systemic circulation in the aorta. All right, so reading graphs is pretty important. So that's really fun to see that. So 120 over 80 is right here. Okay, what about the pressure in a ventricle? What does it vary between? It varies between 120 versus what? Zero. Yeah, when the heart is relaxing, the blood pressure in the ventricle drops to zero. Okay, and indeed that is true. And that's really important because when the pressure is zero, guess what happens to blood? It loves to flow into a ventricle because there's no pressure in the ventricle. So that aids in heart function because it helps the heart load up with blood. Okay, and a ventricle, an atrium, here's a pressure curve from an atrium. And what can you tell me about an atrium compared to a ventricle? Are they strong? Are they big and massive? Or are they kind of thin and weakly? An atrium is really weak. It's a really thin muscle. It barely can produce any pressure or tension at all. Not clinically significant, generally speaking. It produces a very little pressure, okay, during systole right here, and that helps load a little bit of blood into the ventricle, but not very much. Okay, the only time when the atria are really significant is if they're not contracting or if they're fibrillating and not pumping blood, blood has a tendency to pool in an atrium. And what did we just talk about? When blood just kind of sits in one place, maybe in a glass tube, for instance, what does it like to do? It likes to clot. Okay, same thing in an atrium. If an atrium is not functioning and if it's not contracting, it really doesn't matter to the heart except that atrium is going to produce blood clots. And those blood clots are in your heart, and then if it's a left atrium, the blood clot could end up in the brain. If it's the right atrium, that blood clot could end up in the lungs, causing a pulmonary embolism, right? So in that sense, atrial function is real important because we don't want to be generating blood clots. All right, and if that's the case, then maybe somebody needs some anticoagulation therapy, right? So somebody with atrial fibrillation or decreased function might be on an anticoagulation therapy to prevent those blood clots if it can't be treated. All right, so we have a plot of what so far? A plot of sound versus what are we looking at here? Time. And we're looking at electrical activity versus time. And we're looking at what versus time up over here? Blood pressure, and you're familiar with 120 over 80, right? And now you know that actually the blood pressure in a ventricle drops all the way down to zero. We got one more plot to look at. So we got sound, we got electrical activity, we got pressure, and the third one is volume, okay? And this is volume of a ventricle. And this is a really nice plot because these are all justified together with the same time scale so that we can see what's going on inside the heart. All right, and we can see that the volume of a ventricle, okay, gets really big up over here during what? Let's see, let's go over to this part of the graph. The volume is basically it's not quite zero, okay, because it never really goes to zero, but we're going to say this is in milliliters, and I guess that's a 50, maybe a 30. Let's say it's a 50, okay, and then this curve starts to rise up like this, which means what in terms of volume of a ventricle? It's increasing, right? It's increasing during time. And when does the size of a ventricle increase? During diastole, when it is relaxing, right? And so that's why we have diastole right down over here. All right, so ventricular volume increases during diastole. That's when it's filling. And when does the volume of the ventricle decrease? Goes back down over here during systole. All right, so it's a really handy curve. But what we want to do is look at some of these valves when they open and close, okay? And that's what we're going to start with next time. Okay? These crossing points in pressure tell us when various valves in the heart open or close.